Welcome to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio. I'm Coach John Shute.
And I'm Dr. Marcia Mountshute.
Marcia is an author, theologian, and minister.
And John has coached at the highest levels of the game of football for 26 years.
We're Team Shoop, and we're glad you joined us to go deep into some of the most pressing issues of our time.
On Going Deep, we go beyond sound bites and highlight reels. In the news just about every day for the last several weeks, there's been some kind of update on the Take a Knee protest or the anthem protest that has been happening in the NFL now for months, actually two seasons if we trace it back to the person who started this movement. That is Colin Kaepernick, who was a former quarterback of the San Francisco 49ers. The interesting thing about this protest is it started as a statement, a question to American society about how we can tolerate the killing of black men by police at the levels that it is currently at in our society. But it has morphed into a very different conversation as more players have taken knees and even the president of the United States has weighed in. It's become seemingly a conversation about patriotism or loyalty or professionalism or even what punishment should look like in one of our biggest money-making industries in this country, football. So today we want to go deep into this kind of media frenzy around the nature of protest and sports when they intersect and how we react to it and how we listen to voices that are asking us critical questions about our society. Today on Going Deep, we're very fortunate to have Kevin Blackistone with us. Kevin is a longtime sports columnist. He writes for the Washington Post. He also is a panelist on ESPN's Around the Horn. He often is a contributor to National Public Radio. He's written and published about the world of sports on many different topics. Kevin is somebody who also particularly takes a historical view of what's going on right now in the NFL and this atmosphere of protest. So we're very, very fortunate to have Kevin with us today.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for joining us on Going Deep.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
So first off, it's been an interesting time for somebody like Kevin Blackistone to look at what's going on in sports today. Just talk to us about your read on this whole take a knee thing going on in the NFL.
Certainly what we're talking about today, this weekend, this NFL weekend, in terms of the take a knee protest is considerably different than what we were talking about in August of 2016 when Colin Kaepernick first took a knee and explain why he was doing so to Steve Wyche of the NFL Network.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason he explained was because he was protesting the extrajudicial killing of black men in this country that was going unchecked by the justice system. And since then, it has morphed into a debate over freedom of speech, First Amendment rights, whether Colin Kaepernick can get employed again in the NFL, just any manner of things that people have seen as an opportunity to put on this protest. So it's become a lot of things. But, you know, interestingly enough, we've also seen it spread around the country to different sports. We've seen people use it in the streets. We even saw a soccer team over in Europe a few weeks ago drop to a knee before their contest to protest protest in favor of human rights in Europe. So as a gesture, it certainly has has lived on.
Well, if Colin's initial goal was to start a conversation in our country about race and about
police violence,
mm-hmm. boy, he sure did start a conversation, and it, like you said, it continues to morph and morph. And sometimes as I look at the NFL, there was a period of time where I thought then the owners kind of joined this movement, or as you wrote, kind of co-opted this movement. And now with comments made even recently by the Houston Texans owner, Bob mm-hmm. McNair, I'm like, well, nuts, I can't even figure out who's on board or who's off board. I got to look at the paper the next morning to see kind of which way people were going.
Right, and that's kind of what I'm getting at. I mean, I think the protest that Colin Kaepernick started has been usurped by other interests. The interest of the owners who were concerned after Donald Trump made an attack on their bottom line by urging fans of the NFL to turn away from it, to tune it out, if they didn't discipline players who dared to protest during the national anthem. And so then it became, an argument for them to kind of dig their heels in the ground and tell the president that they didn't appreciate him telling them how to run their business. And that's one of the problems. I mean, I think to look at something like Black Lives Matter, which is a movement that continues to voice its displeasure with the justice system in this country, and to look at the strides that it's made and how broad and how far it's gone, you know, there's this distinct difference comparing that to what Colin Kaepernick did, which was to embrace its message. But I think that message really has been lost.
Yeah, that's sort of an interesting dynamic in this particular example of protest. This kind of, you know, it's gone viral, you know, in our contemporary mm-hmm. language. And it's also been co-opted by these different constituencies.
Right.
And I wonder if you can speak a little bit to just, you know, what's all the fuss? Like, why does Donald Trump feel like he needs to speak to it? Why is, you know, why
well, I mean,
is
I think,
this garnering
yeah.
so much
right.
kind of cultural traction for people right now in our country?
Well, I think for Donald Trump, it's part of his Southern strategy. Mm-hmm. You know, this is all race-based. The fact that he would lash out at NFL players who protest during a political rally in Alabama between two ultra-conservative candidates who were replacing another ultra-conservative candidate in Jeff Sessions, who departed that seat to become Attorney General, I think that speaks volumes. So for Trump, I think he has turned NFL players into political pawns on his chessboard, and he uses them or has started to use them to shore up his base. He has used foghorns to remind people of who those players are and what their place in society should be. He has echoed that sentiment that they should just shut up and play, that they should not act on their beliefs, on their thoughts. You know, it's old Southern politics by Donald Trump, and it fits into everything that he used to create the wave that he rode into office.
Now, I coached in the NFL for a long time as an offensive
right.
coordinator and quarterbacks coach, and I can tell you, Colin Kaepernick, while he may not be one of the 32 best quarterbacks in the world, he's certainly one of the 64 best quarterbacks in the world and should be playing in the NFL.
Right.
The fact that he's not is an interesting conversation and a thing you can go down a lot of different rabbit holes. But I think the interesting thing is, and I'd be interested in what you think, he's filed a lawsuit now of collusion against the NFL and their owners, and I just wonder where you think that may come out. As a person who's coached in that league, there's no doubt he's one of the 64 best quarterbacks in the world. There's also no doubt that he'll bring a circus-like atmosphere, not because of his intentions or anything, but there'll be so much drama when you sign a person like Kaepernick that maybe teams aren't willing to deal with. I'll be interested to see where the lawsuit comes out.
I think it's really difficult, and I've been kind of critical of Colin Kaepernick's strategy here because it's been written, it's been said that he was released by the 49ers, but the fact of the matter is that he was under contract to the 49ers,
right.
and he opted out of that. And once he did that, it took some of the teeth away from any legal complaint that he would have against the league that might suggest that it colluded against him because he voluntarily walked away.
That's a good point.
Or that the 49ers somehow wrongfully terminated his employment, which they didn't because, again, he walked away. And so I think, you know, one of the interesting things there, if you read between the lines, is the fact that he filed that collusion case on his own, not with the support of the union. Of course, the union is supporting him as a player. But generally in these sorts of cases, it's the union which carries the legal fight for the player. So it's going to be really, really difficult for him to, I think, prove collusion, despite the fact that you've heard legal experts explain that he only has to prove that one or two teams somehow decided to mount an effort to stop him from getting employment. But it's just going to be really difficult because any and every team can come up with a plausible reason as to why they didn't want to bring him in to their fold. So I don't know, you know, where this is going to wind up, but the last time we saw a case similar to this was Craig Hodges back in the early 90s with the Chicago Bulls after they had won their first championship with Michael Jordan. And Craig Hodges famously went to the White House with the team visit and delivered a letter of grievances from Black America to George Bush, who was president then. And that was the last time that Craig Hodges played in the NBA. Hmm. And a lot of people have argued that the reason for that is his politics and the league didn't want him in. Other people have pointed to the fact that he was 30-something years old and on the downside of his career and his shooting percentage was going down. He really couldn't find a spot in the NBA. Either way, he filed a lawsuit against the NBA and lost handily. So it's going to be difficult for Colin Kaepernick. Had I been advising him, I would have advised him not to opt out of his contract because I think that would have given any legal team that wanted to file wrongful termination or a collusion lawsuit against teams or league a lot more foundation to stand on.
Yeah, I mean, anytime you go up against a behemoth like the NFL, you better have all your T's crossed and your I's dotted because
yep.
They're going to find them.
Absolutely.
So the story about Craig Hodges is a great segue into just let's zoom out a little bit away from Colin Kaepernick and the current, you know, this current dust up around Take a Knee, which, as you said, has just spread all over the world now. Who paved the way for these kind of protests using the platform of sports? There's some famous, iconic moments.
Sure.
Talk to us a little bit about this as a sort of cultural, I don't know what I want to say. It is a muscle twitch or something when people of color who we have idealized on the playing field, on the court, stand up and say, wait a minute, I have some thoughts I want to share.
Right.
And then the country reacts, not monolithically, but certainly powerfully. Speak to that a little bit.
Well, I mean, there have been any number of black athletes who have used sports as a platform to for messaging. And I think, you know, I think one of the reasons is because sports is one of the few places in society where black men in particular are paid any serious attention to. And that's been the case forever. I always remind people that the first time Africans were in the media in this country was on the classified section as human cargo for sale. The second time they were in the media was as athletes, as slave boy jockeys on the plantations that they were brought to, that may have had horses, and they turned into the jockeys. You know, the first Kentucky Derbies were dominated by black jockeys, not only in terms of winners but also in terms of the field. So that's been an arena where people have taken us seriously, while we've been dismissed in a lot of other areas. As a result of that, you know, we have seen black athletes for over 100 years use their athletic talent or their athletic narrative to speak to other issues. Moses Fleetwood Walker, who was the first black baseball player, in the 1880s, well before Jackie Robinson, which is another narrative that's been whitewashed by Major League Baseball and therefore confused in the minds of the public. But after he was run out of baseball, he was a learned man, a graduate of Oberlin in Ohio, and he became a political writer, political thinker, and he wrote a book called Our Home Colony, that I think was published in about 1908, and it was one of the first treaties to criticize America's treatment of the progeny of enslaved Africans, while also suggesting that the best freedom for people like us was to repatriate to Africa. He was even before Marcus Garvey. Then you think, of course, you look at the way Jack Johnson just challenged all the racial mores in society as he was trying to get a chance to fight for the heavyweight championship of the world and eventually gaining that opportunity and winning the fight. You know, throughout the, you know, one of the interesting stories I always think about Jackie Robinson, to me, the Jackie Robinson I celebrate isn't the Jackie Robinson who cut a deal with Major League Baseball to turn the other cheek anytime a racial slight was thrown his way, which, as we know, was constant. But the Jackie Robinson who faced a court martial in 1944 in the Army for refusing to relinquish his seat on a bus at the orders of a white officer, and he won that case because Jackie Robinson was knowledgeable about the law at the time, that it had changed, and that the officer was incorrect. And even if the law had been in place then, it was an immoral law that needed to be challenged. You know, obviously we know about Ali. We know about Carlos and Smith. We forget about the 1965, I believe it was, AFL All-Star Game in New Orleans, at which when black players arrived in New Orleans, they suddenly found out they weren't able to catch cabs. They weren't able to get meals in nice restaurants. Basically, they weren't being able to be serviced because Jim Crow was alive and well in New Orleans. So they banded together and said, we're not going to play this football game. Some of the white players became their allies, and the game never went off. It was moved and played a week or two later in Houston, Texas. And that kind of paved the way for New Orleans to get an NFL franchise in the Saints. Because it forced New Orleans to have to confront its Jim Crow laws and do away with them if it wanted to become a part of 20th century America. So there's been quite a list of people, and then there are other things like the North Carolina A&T lunch counter sit-ins were eventually joined by members of the football team there who provided muscle to their college classmates to keep them from being physically abused by the racists who were backing Jim Crow in North Carolina.
I felt this way other times. I've heard you share so many of these narratives and stories, and I think how different would collegiate athletes right now feel about themselves and their role and their heritage and their power, frankly, if these stories were stories that they knew.
Mm-hmm.
So much of our experience in collegiate sports was just that players they're just walking this thin line. If they're not good soldiers and if they screw up, they're a criminal. Snap. They're
right.
A criminal. That's it. And there is no kind of space for any kind of collective consciousness around you all have power. And if there are problems, I think about what happened at Northwestern when they tried to unionize, just how the reaction against that is swift and it is strong. And it is, if you take part in this kind of behavior, you're out. You're
right.
You're out of the gravy train kind of thing. And I wonder, from your perspective, in terms of how the NFL players, I know we can't speak for all of them, but is there any kind of historical consciousness that you see held collectively among these players about this legacy that they're inheriting of protest and of, as you said, using one of the only places in our society that black voices are heard or listened to.
Well, that's a tremendous burden, right?
To
put on the shoulders of these guys. I mean, we all should be actively involved in our democracy and supporting that which is right and railing against that which is wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a burden for these guys. However, I think slowly but surely some of them are starting to understand the lineage that they are a part of. They may not know that it goes back further than Carlos and Smith, but I think they may have some understanding of it. One of the things that's different now, though, is that really needs to be underscored when it comes to somebody like Colin Kaepernick, or even Kane Coulter, who you alluded to at Northwestern, my alma mater, is that these guys were educated to make the decisions that they made. Colin Kaepernick, the story has come out now that through a friend of his girlfriend, a friend who was teaching a college class out in California, he began to audit that class because he's interested in the topic. And he read things like Patricia Hill Collins's seminal work on black feminist thought, which has a lot to do with black male masculinity and how the system frames you for everyone to see. So, it was education that got him to do what he did. The same is true with Kane Coulter. He spent I believe he spent one summer taking a class in labor, and that class kind of opened his eyes to the place of college athletes within the college athletic industrial complex. And so that's what spurred him to begin to think about the idea of unionizing his fellow classmates on that football team. And then obviously when you look back to the 60s, you know, many athletes were educated through the civil rights movement, which had classrooms in cities and or organizations like SNCC who had, you know, meetings to educate people about their place in society and how to confront racism and discrimination. It's more than just someone suggesting to you that you need to thrust your fist into the night air or take a knee during the play of the national anthem. And it requires education. It requires commitment. It requires understanding. It requires a lot of things that aren't necessarily going to be born just in the clubhouse or in the locker room.
In addition to coaching in the NFL for a long time, Marsh and I knew many young men that we coached in college, incredibly bright young men who knew this situation was unfair.
Right.
Who understood there's a lot of money going around and we ain't getting any of it.
Right.
It's one thing sometimes when I look at Colin Kaepernick and I think it's a little bit easier to stand up for something when you've got a couple million in your pocket already. If he never plays football again, Colin Kaepernick has enough money to live the rest of his life. Some of these young men that we've been around recognize the same injustices but are scared because they don't have that same situation to fall back on. What would you recommend? And I don't know Kane Coulter's, you know, family situation or anything like that, but young men in college, what could they do to make their voice heard that and they might be unwilling to take that risk knowing I could get kicked out? Because, frankly, Marsha and I got kicked out.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, one of the things I would say is, you know, and I say this after, you know, knowing of Stokely Carmichael, and I mentioned this the other day, but one of the things is to be organized. You know, that's one of the most, I think, important things. People have to understand that a mass movement is just that. It's not an individual, but it's a mass movement. And so you have to be, you know, Stokely Carmichael always called on black and poor folk to be organized. You know, what organization are you in? You know, he went throughout the South, starting when he was a student at Howard University, trying to organize people to vote, to do those sorts of things. So that's one thing. You know, but that's really hard on a college campus for college athletes. That's really hard.
Certainly easier said than done.
And
that's right,
part of the plan. I really think it's part of the plan. It keeps them in their place. They don't have time. They can't get involved in the life of the campus the same way.
Exactly. So, you know, they have to understand their importance to their university and make demands on the university that the university makes on them. I mean, if you're going to be, and that's, I mean, I think that's one of the problems with the whole marriage of college athletics and the college campus is that the two mission statements are divergent. If you're a student on campus, if you're an athlete on campus, I mean, you need to be involved in student government. You need to be involved in the racial and ethnic student groups that are on campus. You can't separate yourself from them. You need to take an economics class and make sure that, you know, the first book you read, and I was thinking about this year because I think it was the 150th anniversary of Das Kapital or something like that. You know, the opening part of that book, which explains what a commodity is and what value is, like, should be read by, like, every college athlete, especially those, right, in a revenue-generating sport.
Right.
So you can understand your place.
You are a commodity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So they need to, you know, they need to really understand that and take that forward with them when they get into the pros. And once again, you know, be a part of an organization. You know, be a part of your union.
Mm-hmm.
You know, your union is a part of the AFL-CIO. You know, be active in that union.
As you talk about players on the collegiate campuses getting more involved and being a part of the life of the campus. I remember when John was coaching at Purdue, Angela Davis was coming to speak on campus. And so I tried to tell all the players about it. I brought flyers over there. They had they hadn't heard one word about her coming.
And that and what a tragedy it is, because
it's so tragic.
Because if they want to understand strength,
yes,
right? If they want to understand fortitude,
yep,
and what it takes to win,
go listen
there's
to Angela
nobody
Davis.
Nobody who they could hear more from than Angela Davis.
Exactly. And I ended up going, and of course there were no athletes there of any sport whatsoever. And at the same time that she was speaking, the football team had a meeting scheduled.
Sure.
And I just thought, you know, this isn't an accident.
Right.
You know, this is not an accident. And after John asks his question, I want to zoom back into our contemporary moment and talk about some of the patterns we see in terms of trying to put Black voices and Black bodies back in their place. And that those conversations are veiled in terms of patriotism and in terms of, you know, loyalty and and professionalism and things like that. But I know John has another question about what you were just talking about. Go ahead.
Well, no, a comment and a question. I agree it would be wonderful for students to take those economic classes. While we were teaching at the, or coaching at the University of North Carolina, Devin Ramsey, a wonderful student who ended up ultimately being banned by the NCAA, but a wonderful, unjustifiably, but a wonderful student, wanted to take a fourth level economics class, and our
academic advisors
told him, "You're not allowed to take that class because we don't have tutors for that class." And he said, "I didn't ask you for a tutor. I said, I want to take this class. I've got a 3.5 GPA. They said, we don't know that professor, and we don't have a relationship with them. You can't take that class. So I think it's a way that, as Marcia said, this is more intentional than certainly I realized before I started coaching in college. And when you talk about organization, the first thing that pops into my mind is the University of Missouri football team. Sometimes you might, you know, they organized a couple of years ago, and less than 48 hours later, the president of the university has lost his job.
Absolutely.
And the power that players have is phenomenal to me. Why, in your estimation, has that not occurred more? I mean, when that happened at the University of Missouri, and those changes occurred with, I mean, there was a guy that was about to die who was on a health
hunger strike.
Grad student.
He's about to die. The university doesn't budge at all, doesn't budge at all, doesn't budge at all. And then all of a sudden the football team says, we're not going to play BYU this weekend in Arrowhead Stadium, and the university is about to lose a few million dollars. It changes overnight.
Right.
I thought at that point everything's going to change. Players are going to realize how powerful they are right now, and they can make a difference. In your estimation, how close are we to that happening? And maybe I'm wondering sometimes why that hasn't happened again.
Right. Well, you know, it's a that's an anomaly,
yes.
And you know, we saw it there. We saw it at sadly at Grambling, where players banded together and got some action. But I don't think people realize that. I think people are fearful of doing those things. As one player told me, one NFL player told me earlier this year, that when you've been inculcated as an athlete for so long, your ethics are moored to your sport. They're not moored to society.
So
your first reaction is from the point of view of your game. It's not from the point of view of you as a citizen on the planet. That's, you know, just very, very unusual. But once again, it speaks to when people pay attention or who they pay attention to, because I had a column on that piece, and one of the things I did was to use an analytics tool to measure the public's response to what was going on there, and I just looked at social media, and yeah, that grad student's on his deathbed and the needle is not moving. But as soon as the football team came out and said they wouldn't play the next weekend, the graph just shot through the roof.
Yep.
All of a sudden, everybody paid attention, and it became an international story at that particular point. So it shows the power of protest on the athletic stage, and it shows the power in particular that black athletes have if they want to wield it.
You know, and it's interesting, I really appreciate what that player said about their ethics to their sport. For 26 years, I was embedded in the world of big-time football,
mm-hmm.
and I always felt that. I did. I felt like I got to do what's best for the team. And it wasn't until towards the end of my coaching career, really, as my son was coming up through sports and then what happened while we were at the University of North Carolina, these players that I loved kind of getting steamrolled, I started feeling to myself, hold on, there's a bigger ethic here that for 20 years I haven't even paid attention to. And that really just kind of punched me in the gut right there when you said that. It resonates with me a great deal.
Yeah, and then the other thing I would say is that, getting back to something you were saying, Marcia, but black males on white campuses are primarily there to be athletes who produce revenue for the university corporation. And I say that with assurity because Sean Harper, who's now at University of Southern California, but was the founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Equity in Education at UPenn, had done a couple studies where he looked at the percentages of black players on Division I football and basketball teams, which for football teams it was like 57%, and for basketball teams it was 64%. And then he juxtaposed that to the percent of black males on those campuses, which was not more than 3%.
Right.
So that just shows you that they're not there to be, universities don't bring them in to be part of the educating class. And mm-hmm. back to what you were saying, John, about what courses they want to take. They're not there to be part of the educating class like everyone else on campus. They're there to produce revenue.
They're not there to go hear Angela Davis speak.
No, yeah. not at all. Not unless she's going to give some pep talk about beating state.
Right.
Come the weekend.
Right, exactly. And it kind of gets back to what you were saying at the very beginning of these two, this duality of mission statements, you know, that universities mm-hmm. have that are in direct contradiction to one another. So just as we finish up, I want to hear some of your thoughts, if you are willing to share them, about the societal reaction toward black bodies and black voices,
right.
who feeling empowered, wanting to speak, wanting to say their experience of this country or of a university or of a social issue, and it seems to be a very deeply embedded pattern that there are ways our society talks about race without talking about race or thinking
right.
they're talking about race. Can you speak to that a little bit about how we're seeing that?
Sure.
Right
and,
now,
yeah,
again?
And even the conversation that we're having around Colin Kaepernick and the NFL and Donald Trump, my buddy Bill Roden was pointing this out the other day, is, you know, what we need to be talking about in these terms is racism,
mm-hmm.
right, and not race. We need to go to the next step up, because that's really what we're talking about. But, you know, it's interesting how it gets, we've talked about how the Colin Kaepernick thing has been usurped by other stakeholders, how his protest has been defanged through that same method, how we in the media and then therefore the public totally misrepresent what's going on. So the focus now is on what people call anthem protests, which has nothing to do with what Colin Kaepernick was doing. He used the anthem to protest the killing of black men in this country by those on police forces who then wind up getting away, it seemed, scot-free. It's not an anthem protest. Right. I was never mad at the anthem. And then you get the question raised by those of us in the media, and it's echoed by others, about whether or not that is disrespectful to the troops, which, right, again, has nothing to do with any of this. So all of a sudden it becomes a review of theater. You know, how did we like the play? And then those of us in the media, we started doing a head count every weekend. Who's standing? Who's kneeling? Who's sitting? Who has a fist in the air? Who has a hand on the shoulder of someone who's kneeling? How many were there this week? How many will there be next week? It gets reduced to quantification rather than elevated to qualification. If you're going to protest and you have a message, you just need to be steadfast. You need to be direct. You can't allow yourself to be derailed or diminished. In order for that not to happen to you, you know, you really need to be educated. You really need to be prepared to take on these struggles, to amplify these struggles that you see yourself a part of. And unfortunately, you know, there a lot of the athletes who are involved, just like those of us in the public who get involved in some of these struggles, we get into it sometimes for the excitement of them, for the appearance, for the theatrics, and not really for the real messaging that needs to be put out.
Right. And I would add to that part of what, when you kind of step into these waters, part of the wisdom that needs to come along with you is what's going on when people make it about the anthem or about,
right,
you know, I would respond to Bill Roden's thing about race versus racism is what we're really talking about is white supremacy. Mm-hmm. That's what we're talking about. And
sure.
And we flip the script on people who are trying to say something about our culture that's critical and make it about something else where we can win the argument. Nobody
right.
wants to be against the anthem. You know, nobody wants to be against the troops. So
right.
we take a valid complaint and something we really do need to look at, and we flip it and make it about something in which whiteness is going to win.
Right.
This kind of dominant narrative of it's good to be, it's good to submit to authority, it's good to be patriotic, it's good to shut up and do your job, it's good, you know, and there's so deeply embedded in there of stay in your place.
Yeah, and that's what you saw in the Bob McNair quote about not being able to let the prisoners
run the prison,
the inmates run the prison.
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole lot of imagery there, but the biggest part of it is control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to be in control of how they behave, and that's what comes through a lot in sports. I mean, when you think about how much athletes are controlled, not only on the field, but off the field as well. And here's an attempt to control their minds.
Yeah, that's what football's all about. Mm-hmm. Control.
Mm-hmm. It really is.
It really is. And more than basketball. I mean, it's just more about conformity and control.
Yeah. Yeah, but you know, we've even seen that in basketball because, mm-hmm. you know, that was one of the reactions of David Stern's NBA to the fight that happened years ago in Detroit between the Indiana Pacers
and Sprewell,
and that one too, and Detroit and the unruly fans who
sure.
happened to be in that Detroit arena that time. It was all about control. I mean, down to it morphed into theatrics. Mm-hmm. You know, how do these players look? Will they appeal to our sponsors? So therefore, I'm going to get with the Players Association, and we're going to implement a dress code,
right,
to make them dress more like the 60 and 70 year old lawyers that I work with on Fifth Avenue than the young adult and 20 something black males from the neighborhoods in which they grew up, which would seem like a natural thing you'd want to do fashion wise.
So
it really does become about control.
As always, Kevin, whether it's on ESPN or whether it's in the Washington Post, you've given me a lot to think about, and I appreciate it. I'm going to get home tonight, and I'm going to read about Moses Fleetwood Walker. I can tell you that for sure.
Great story.
But yeah, I'm really interested in that, you know, and I'm really interested in so much of what you said from the 65.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and just last week, the state of Ohio declared it. A few weekends ago now, but they declared one Saturday Moses Fleetwood Walker Day.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and finally celebrated him all these years later.
Oh,
there you
wow.
go.
You've been listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio, NPR for Western North Carolina. Tell us what you think of the show by emailing us at goingdeep@bpr.org. And make sure you like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @ShoopsGoingDeep.